Side Guru taking pictures in the back. Our technical specialist tonight is Jason Hatman. Our speaker tonight is the executive director of one of the state's oldest and most famous historical societies, the Filson Society, founded in 1884 and currently housed in the Ferguson Mansion on South 3rd Street in Louisville, Kentucky. A native of Tifton, Georgia, Mark grew up in Milan, Georgia, where he attended public schools and dreamed about being an archaeologist or even a lawyer. After a stint in the U.S. Navy, he enrolled at Georgia Southern College, where he received a B.A. and M.A. in history, and transferred to the University of Tennessee for his Ph.D. He says he was most influenced by the Southern sense of place, Southern history, and Southern literature. His love of history came from reading and hearing older people talk about people and the past. His research has focused on people and their lives in the area he grew up in, the Piney Woods of Georgia, which he was telling about is extreme southwest part of Georgia. And the research focused on the period from 1850 to 1910. In his first book, The New South Comes to Wiregrass, Georgia, 1860 to 1910, published by the University of Tennessee Press in 1994, he explored the transformation of an area characterized by pine forests, northern tourists, and health seekers to one of cotton production and tenancy. It won the American Historical Association's Herbert Fies Prize. His most recent book, Plain Folks Fight, The Civil War and Reconstruction in Piney Woods, Georgia, was published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2005 and won an award of excellence from the Georgia Secretary of State's office. In it, he examines the effects of the Civil War on the rural southern home front in the Wiregrass region of southern Georgia. Mark has held a variety of professional positions, serving as director of the East Tennessee Historical Society, the South Carolina Historical Society, and assuming his present position in Louisville at the Filson Club in 1993. In August of this year, he announced plans for a $6.4 million expansion of the Filson Society's properties in Old Louisville. His interest in steamboating on the western waters goes back to his childhood and a fishing camp he once visited on the Ocmulgee River, where he heard stories about steamboats. Since moving to Louisville, he's expanded on that interest through the rich collections of Kentucky and Ohio Valley history at the Filson. Please give a warm welcome to Mark Wetherington.
First of all, can you hear me?
Yes.
In the back?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here in Bowling Green. And I want to thank Western Kentucky University Library Series for inviting me. And I have a word that will assure you right away. We're not going to talk about the Piney Woods in Georgia today. Tonight we're going to talk about the Western waters and steamboating. And one of the things that I've really been amazed by in being in the Ohio Valley now since 1993, as Brian mentioned, was coming from South Georgia, where we had very small rivers in the central part of the state, no wider than the Green and the Barron in this neighborhood, and learning that actually, as a child, that before there had been steamboats on those rivers. And I can't imagine how anybody could get on a river and move a boat around on it, on a river that narrow, with full of stumps, and get anywhere and haul anything on it. And so I came up here to the Ohio, and which, of course, is a huge river, very wide. And it looks even wider now than it was then because of the dams and the sort of slack water navigation that was put in over the years. But to me, the most fascinating thing was that we were heading toward next year, in 2011, the bicentennial, not the centennial or the sesquicentennial, the bicentennial, 200 years of steamboating out here on the western waters. Our mission at the Filson quickly is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and the Ohio River history and culture. And we do that like your library does and your special collection at Western does through collecting books, manuscripts, photographs. In a digital age, I always like to point out that these are very authentic, original, and very often unique items, especially the manuscripts. They're only one of a kind, and if you lose them, they're gone forever. So I began to look at the Filson's collections and some other collections to see what kind of story I could tell about this bicentennial here in the Western Waters. This is an image from the Western Kentucky University collection. And they also did a great job on this opening picture here. This poster is a really great one. Well, the Western Waters, this is Basil Hall's map of the United States in the 1820s, the late 1820s. The Western Waters, as they were called by contemporaries then, stretch really from Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh area, all the way off this map toward Helena, Montana, and from present-day Minneapolis-St. Paul area all the way down to New Orleans. This was a huge field of enterprise for anyone who could figure out a way to get a technology out there and move people, because that's where everybody was headed on this continent, was out west. If you take that area I just described and you think about it in terms of the present-day United States, it's basically half the present-day United States is would be included in some portion of the Western Waters. 16,000 miles of river out here. So when people started thinking about a technology that would let you develop that vast territory, there was quite a competition to come up with something that worked. Tonight we're going to talk about primarily the Ohio Valley region, that the watershed of the Ohio Valley, that part of the Western Waters. Not so much the Mississippi or the Missouri. This is the Ohio from Leavenworth, Indiana, looking down, really looking west as the river leads on downstream toward Paducah. And there were all kinds of ideas launched about what kind of boat would work out here very early on. And you had John Fitch, who came up with a steam-powered boat and demonstrated its capability on a pond in New York in 1796. I'm just fascinated by how early this technology went. He couldn't find really backers to support his project, and he died in 1798. You had James Rumsey, a Virginian, who built a working model of a steamboat, but he died in 1792 before it could be perfected. And finally, you had Robert Fulton, Claremont, which steams on the Hudson River in 1807. And Fulton then attempts to stake out a monopoly based on his design in the United States, in these Western Waters. He wants to control what is happening out here. And Fulton saw Fitch's designs. And this, let's see. This image of the model is one of Fitch's designs, and this is basically a model that's at the Smithsonian. It's not at the Filson, but if you notice it, one of the things that early inventors tried to do was take the vessels they knew in the East, which were deep hull vessels that were traveling on bays and rivers and along coastal trade, and fit them up with some sort of boilers and engines, and then fit them to something they knew could move a boat. And what that turned out to be in this particular version of Fitch's design were oars. I don't know if you can see in the back of the room, but these are oars, two rows of oars that are supposed to somehow propel this this vessel along. Henry Shreve is the person who basically came along and took these earlier designs and packaged them into a format, a model, a plan that would allow them to sail these Western Waters. And Shreve had been a keelboat man between Pittsburgh and New Orleans. He had run this whole trade route all the way down the Ohio and down the Mississippi. And for Shreve, in one of his early steamboat designs, he tried to use that deep-hulled version, and it didn't work because the rivers, remember, the Ohio River you see today isn't the Ohio River that Lewis and Clark saw, and none of the rivers are. These were very shallow rivers at periods of drought and little rain. You had to virtually sometimes get out and shove these kill boats from one pool to the next. So Shreve decided, well, I've got to come up with a design that will work out here, or nothing's going anywhere. And so most of the Western steamboats we've come to know are based on Shreve's design. What Shreve did was he took the boiler, which is here, and the engine, which is here, out of the hull that you saw in that earlier design and put them on the deck. And what that allowed him to do then was to make the hull much shallower. It's not as deep as a sort of ocean-going boat would be. And by moving the boiler and the engine up out of the hull, it also meant you could store cargo in the hull. Now, this is a side-wheeler. This is a model of the General. It's in the Filson's collection. And the model itself is from the mid-1800s. So it's been around a long time. It's contemporaneous with the steamboat design itself. Now, just basically, this is the main deck. This is the boiler deck. That's the deck above the boiler. And most of the cabins and staterooms are along this deck. And this is the pilot house. And this is the wheelhouse. So what we have are patterns of design that are going to repeat over and over again as we move along through time. What you see eventually is regular packet service along the Ohio, along the Barren, the Green, the Tennessee, the Cumberland, the Kentucky, all of the rivers in this whole watershed. And people were really not prepared for this technology when it arrived on the Ohio in 1811. Next year, 200 years. They didn't know what to expect. Many people had not heard that this technology was even on the horizon. So in 1811, when the first steamboat arrives, Fulton's boat, this is what Ben Cassaday wrote in the History of Louisville in the 1850s in looking back on this early public reaction to a steamboat. Late at night on the fourth day after quitting Pittsburgh, they arrived in safety at Louisville, having been but 70 hours descending upwards of 700 miles. If you do the math, that's 10 miles an hour. The novel appearance of the vessel and the fearful rapidity with which it made its passage over broad reaches of river excited a mixture of terror and surprise among the settlers on the banks. Where the rumor of such an invention had never reached. I have heard that the general impression among the Kentuckians was that the comet had fallen into the Ohio. And the comet was the great comet of 1811. So people were really amazed at this new technology, the speed that boats could travel. The Patrick Henry. It says it commits running as a regular packet between Maysville and Cincinnati and continuing trade without interruption except such as is consequent to repairs. In other words, this technology broke down and you might be sitting on the river and might hit a snag or a stump. So here we have this early commercial enterprise out here, and we've got a design that works, so we've got competition and we've got steamboats beginning to really change the landscape of the West, change the cities and towns along the rivers, both large and small. This is the Louisville waterfront in the 1840s. Probably the baseball field down there, the bats would be somewhere out in here. But you can see the steamboats lined up on the river and how all the businesses and buildings are facing this large wharf area. And based on the image you saw earlier of Bowling Green, it's not really a whole lot different if you can imagine this waterfront down here being a working waterfront for steamboats. Steamboats competed with keelboats. I mentioned Shreve had been in the keelboat business, but they didn't drive them out entirely. These coexisted for a while with rafts. And also, this was the way, more and more, that immigrants were going to get out here into the West. Germans, Irish. Now, they weren't going to be in the cabins I pointed out a minute ago. They were primarily going to be on deck passage down here on the deck. Travel on these roads and trails took days if you wanted to walk or if you could get a horse. But again, on a steamboat going downriver, it's 10 to 15 miles per hour. Freight could arrive on these wharfs in a timely manner. So you could order goods, depend on them arriving, and sell them fairly quickly in stores and shops. So you had some dependency and reliability in this form of transportation. Prior to that, it had been wagons, teamsters hauling goods in. A steamboat boom begins to emerge in the 1820s. Between 1821 and 1831, 270 steamboats were launched on the rivers watering the Mississippi Valley region. 270 steamboats. That's a lot of new technology rolling out of these communities and being placed on the rivers. Some important dates. 1811, the New Orleans reaches Louisville. That's the first steamboat out here. 1828 is the date I have for the McLean reaching Bowling Green. Never is when a steamboat reaches Lexington. And one of the urban historians, Richard Wade, wrote in his book that the steamboat's injury to Lexington's commerce was fatal. Lexington basically could not regain its preeminence as an urban area. Louisville overtook it primarily because of the introduction of this new technology. So it's an important thing to remember when we talk about cities and their growth and their patterns. In the 1830s, Louisville surpasses Lexington in population, and during the same period, New Albany is the biggest city in Indiana. And New Albany and Louisville and these communities around the falls of the Ohio really began to become a steamboat industrial complex. So if you can imagine that, New Albany, eventually Portland, Louisville, Jeffersonville, all of those communities are involved in turning out steamboat after steamboat. Imagine waking up one day and going out inside and seeing this appearing in your yard. Somebody is building a steamboat here on the bank. And look at all the materials that are going into this boat. Lots of lumber. You needed good wood, and there was a lot of wood on both banks of the Ohio, all up and down the Green River, the Barren River. Sawmills were popping up supplying this trade. We talk about 270 boats in a short period. That's a lot. These were basically floating hotels. And that's one a month in some periods. It's a huge amount. Here is the Paducah flood wall. If you've never been out to Paducah and had a chance to see the paintings down there to depict the steamboat history, you can see these are the ways right here in which boats are built, put together, and basically slip off into the river and began their career moving people and cargoes up and down all the rivers out here in the western waters. Same thing was happening at Clarksville, Portland, at Cincinnati, at Evansville, at Madison, at Paducah. Boat after boat being produced. And not only were the boats being produced, but there were a lot of other sort of spin-off businesses that went with the boats. The boat you saw a little while ago sitting on the bank being put together still had to get boilers, still had to get engines, and it still had to get all those staterooms furnished. And if you look at this is a city directory with advertisements in it from the 1840s for New Albany and Louisville. And you can see here, in this 20-year period, there's 204 steamboats built at New Albany alone. You build a steamboat, you've got to put something in those rooms. And if you've got a couple of hundred rooms, 150 rooms, you've got to have tables, chairs. I came across a very interesting reference by Arthur Hopkins, who was a judge in Louisville, and he was like the steamboat collector of images, anything to do with steamboats. The Hopkins collection is at the Filson, and I understand you have a steamboat collection here at Western. He said that a couple of artists in Louisville, Carl Brenner and Harvey Joyner, got their starts as artists painting small landscapes, because these landscapes were put over the doors to staterooms or on the walls inside staterooms. And so they just turned them out over and over. And if you go and you look at the size of a lot of those paintings, they are maybe this wide and this tall, a lot of them. So maybe Judge Hopkins was onto something. Well, this is the main cabin of the steamboat J.M. White, a post-Civil War steamboat. And if you look at this, you may have to come up here later, or maybe you can see it here. These are all chairs down both sides. And then down the center, these are all sofas. And then there's a piano here. So every stateroom had furniture. Outside the stateroom, in the main interior cabin, you had all of these chairs. These were all rearranged at mealtime by stewards to serve meals in this main cabin. And then on the outside of the cabin, there was a door that led out on the boiler deck, where you could have a seat and watch the countryside go by. You could watch the landscape slip along by your window. Look at the wood in this image, sort of the steamboat Gothic idea. You hear an architect, and these boats were just turned out over and over over the years. Now, not all the boats were huge like this, where you could actually have a string band on board and move these chairs back and start dancing. It was great places of social connection. Usually toward the bow of the boat, there was a bar where people, the men would gather and have a drink, play cards. But they weren't all this big and this grand, because if you could downsize the model of Shreve and build it smaller, you could get on smaller rivers and serve even more people. So you end up with little steamboats that look like this one. This boat was called the J.C. Hopkins. It was on the big Sandy River in eastern Kentucky. And to me, this little thing right here still is Shreve's design and model. Here is the boiler. He's got it on the deck. The engine's back here. These little side wheels were referred to by people as bat wings, because they would spin so fast they reminded people of bats flying by. And notice they don't even put the covering over the wheels. The wheelhouse isn't there. So this is about like what we would call back in the 50s and 60s, sort of hot rod. You know, they don't have, it's a sort of like a jalopy. There's no hood here. There's no fenders over the wheels. You get it stripped down and run it. And look at these passengers. I mean, you saw the main cabin of the J.M. White. Well, look at the Hopkins. Here are your three cabins. And the deck passengers are down here somewhere, along with whatever they're hauling on the river that day. Now, passengers that had some money could really travel in style. And this is a man named Bornemann Bull, who was a virtuoso violinist who traveled all over America. He was from Denmark, but he was a Norwegian nationalist. And everywhere he went, he would play his violin. He had a troupe that traveled with him. Supposedly, he played up in Mammoth Cave, and there's supposed to be a room that at one time had his name associated with it, because he gave concerts. And he traveled all up and down the Ohio, had a stateroom, and would go to the bar and talk up Norwegian nationalism. Norway wasn't its own country until, I think, about 1905. And there's an interesting story about this man. that I'll get to in a little bit. I'll go ahead and tell it now. He was on the Steamboat America when it collided with the United States in 1868, which was the worst steamboat disaster in Ohio River history. But not everybody could afford a stateroom. If you were an immigrant and you were low on cash, you got down and you booked deck passage. And you saw where the deck was. It's with the boilers. It's with the engines. It was loud. And all kinds of cargo was placed on the deck. Anything that couldn't fit in the hull went on the deck. And so if you're a deck passenger, you may not ever really know who your next door neighbor might be. Here they come. It might be livestock. You just got to move over. Here's an image of a gangplank. Just drop right in a cornfield, and you run the livestock up in there, and it's move over deck passengers. And you might only have a fence or a wall out of wood separating your space from livestock. They don't call Cincinnati Porkopolis for anything, remember? And they herded this livestock and cattle on here and headed up the river. This is a good point to make right here, is that most of these steamboats made their money off cargo. They didn't really make them off passengers. It was moving goods. This is Harlan Hubbard's painting, it's in the Filson's collection, of the steamboat Fleetwood. And what I wanted to point out here is steamboat technology allowed these riverine communities and towns to prosper. And here you see the Fleetwood just packed to the gills with people and supplies on this main deck. The boiler deck up here, you can see the stateroom cabins with people have more space here. But what I really want to draw your attention to here is this background in the painting. And that's a river bend with a floodplain and some rich farmland. And you can pick out a few buildings up here of prosperous farmers. This pattern is repeated everywhere there's a bend and low land that is basically flooded in high water. And deposits, alluvial deposits, are made on this land. That's on every river, Ohio, the Barren, the Green, wherever you've got some land that's low, you're going to be able to raise crops and get them on steamboats. And one of the fascinating things about the steamboat timing to me is that if you were on the Indiana shore, let's say, in 1810, 1811, you were just beginning to settle up that northern side of the river. And one of the early accounts of people settling up in Switzerland County in Indiana had this to say about 1810. Quote, "The first settlers of Posey Township found it occupied along the river by a lawless set of half-civilized beings driven from Kentucky by the terrors of the whipping post, at which certain acts of larceny was, by the laws of the state, punished. They cultivated small patches of ground, but subsisted principally upon what they gathered from the woods and the river." So we've got people up here living hand in mouth, living off the land, but understand what happens within a year is that first steamboat comes through. So it's not like you went out and you settled and you worked for a generation and the steamboat got there and everything began to progress. If you're on the north side of the Ohio, your settlement and the arrival of steamboats becomes almost contemporaneous, and it really speeds things up. Towns prospered, river towns. This is an image of Bowling Green during the Civil War, but you get the idea here of steamboat service and the community in the background and a landing and the opportunity for our community to grow, whereas before it may not have had much opportunity to get with the outside world except by roads and wagons. For some reason, the 1850s... is called the Golden Age of Steamboats. Now, this is a watercolor painting in the Filson collection somewhere on the Ohio, but you can see a whole lot of activity And you can see a couple of steamboats here and some people in a small boat rowing around. But it sort of captures the image of the Golden Age. But what we see happening are more and more boats getting on the river and using the waterways. In 1851, 1,456 steamboats used the Portland Canal. Now, that's not different steamboats, but that's boats moving up and down the river through that canal. 1,400. In 1852, there were 53 steamboats on at Louisville, and somebody was asking me about a steamboat earlier that was in their family. Based on the statistics of these boats, they employed, the 53 boats, 1,900 people. It represented $1.2 million in capital invested, which means the average steamboat cost about $22,641 then, and the average boat employed about 36 people. So that industrial complex not only turns out the boats, but it's employing people who are working on the boats and people who are working in, say, the marine hospitals. There was a marine hospital in Louisville. There was a marine hospital in Paducah, almost identical. So all of these sort of infrastructure pieces are coming together for this golden age of steamboats. Well, the reason I sort of questioned the golden age idea was, have I mentioned to you yet that traveling on a steamboat is dangerous? It's very dangerous. Boom. That's it. You've got a boiler explosion. Bad things can happen to you on a steamboat. The average life of a steamboat is less than 5 years. So if you put $20,000 something dollars on it, you do the math of whatever that would be today, it would probably be over $400,000. You could lose your boat pretty quickly. Snags, rocks, wrecks, fires, boiler explosions, collisions. There were so many disasters out here that 1,200 people were killed in only 2 years, 1850 to 1852. This is a man who's in Cave Hill Cemetery who died later, 1868. His name is William Garvin. Some of you have been in old Louisville and know, I've heard of Garvin Place. It was named for him. He died in that 1868 collision of those two huge steamboats. So many boats blew up that they brought out Lloyd's Steamboat Directory to keep up with all the boats that had been placed on the river. Notice that it's got a sort of boring title that I just mentioned, Lloyd's Steamboat Directory, but right under it, it's got a really interesting title for the public. Disasters on the Western Waters. There's nothing like a disaster to sell a book. So we got a book chock full of lists of steamboats. Then we got the book. The rest of it is filled up with page after page of disasters. This image is, you can't see it from your seat, is the Lucy Walker. So if you go into Lloyd's Steamboat Directory and you turn to page 143, you find a description of the explosion of the Lucy Walker, which goes something like this. At the moment of the accident, the air appeared to be filled with human beings. Let's see. Yeah, there's one right there. That may be part of one, you know, but let's get it in there. You know, this is sort of sell the book. With dissevered limbs and other fragments of human bodies. One man was blown to the height of 50 yards, as the narrator judges. Another was cut in two by a piece of boiler. Many other incidents, equally distressing and horrifying, are related. So you want to get this book to learn about steamboat disasters. This is the collision of the United States and America on December the 4th, 1868. 74 people were killed. 25% of them were women. People were horrified by this wreck, basically due to pilot error. I got a talk that basically deals with this disaster. But, whoops, you see right here, an awful lot of flames on the United States. And what happened here, in addition to pilot error, you know, we have to have disasters, don't we, to learn lessons? According to the newspapers in what they could figure out from the manifest. The United States had on its main deck, stacked up along the guards, which were the part of the main deck that reached out beyond the hull, so that if the boat ran into anything vertical, a tree, a stump, it would sort of bounce off. Those guards, that flat area, was covered with barrels of petroleum. And so once these boats hit, that petroleum, the barrels are knocked over, well, they're going to run into the water and they're going to run toward the furnaces and the boilers. So you have immediately just huge fire breaks out. And you can see a little bit of it here. Problem with people trying to escape and jump overboard was that the water was on fire because the petroleum was being pulled downriver and the boats were drifting downriver. How many of you have been to Warsaw, Kentucky? Okay, Warsaw is upriver from Carrollton, between Carrollton and Covington, on the south bank. And there's a little history marker there that says that 170-something people died, but most people think that's basically inaccurate. What happened in the 1850s were these 1850s, 60s, and 70s were these incredible disasters that really began to take some of the romance and sort of nostalgic look of it began to wear thin because so many people were dying. By 1872, 3,800 lives had been lost due to steamboat wrecks. That's a lot of people dying out on the water. So, 1850s, golden age, 1860s. What about the Sultana? Some of you probably heard of the wreck of the Sultana, which is the worst steamboat disaster in American history in 1865. This steamboat had about 1,500 people on it. Over 1,500 people, and 1,500 people died. 1,100 of them were Union soldiers who were very weak and had been in southern prison camps, had been in Union hospitals down south. It burned about 50 miles north of Memphis on the Mississippi River, and the total loss of life for this this disaster was greater than the sinking of the Titanic. But I haven't seen anybody out there, you know, from Woods Hole or whatever, trying to drop down in the Mississippi and find a piece of the Sultana. But the sort of collective situation is that huge disasters like the Sultana and like the United States and the America are moving people to sort of think about, well, you know, if I can get on a steamboat and ride along and die, you know, I might as well take my chances on a railroad. And not, you know, at least there, if it runs off the rails and I hit the ground and survive, I can get up and walk off, and I'm not going to drown. This is, of course, the bridge of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad over the Green River up at Munfordville. And I don't know which way the train's moving, and but you can see this technology allows the rails to expand, span these huge distances. And a German immigrant, I don't know if he arrived on a steamboat, a German immigrant by the name of Mr. Fink came into Louisville and designed for the Louisville and Nashville Railroad. He was formerly in the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. These Fink truss bridges. The first bridge across the Ohio was a Fink truss bridge. So if you're interested in engineering, this is something that might you might want to remember. We're still at the Filson. We have a large portrait of Mr. Fink. And anytime there is a convention of engineers in Louisville, two or three of them will walk in eventually during a week. And they'll want to see where Fink's portrait hangs. And they'll go up to the program room, and there is Fink's portrait. Some railroad construction projects that are significant. The Madison to the Indianapolis Railroad line was completed in 1850. That began to pull goods up from the north bank of the Ohio toward Indianapolis. Lexington to Louisville was completed in 1851. Anytime you could stand in Louisville and have to choose going east, whether you're going to ride one of those dangerous boats or get on a railroad, and we know trains had wrecks too, you're going to probably get on the Lexington to Louisville Road. As a matter of fact, Some of the people who died, some of the people who survived that disaster between the United States and America didn't wait for another steamboat. They got to the nearest railroad line they could and went on east. A couple of them were U.S. congressmen who didn't bother telling anybody that they were going to do that. And they were looking for them in the water for a couple of weeks until they realized word got back that they were already in Washington, D.C. This is an item that I wanted to show you because of its connection here locally. This is a manuscript item that we acquired recently from some early LNN papers that we were able to get. And what this says is a specification for laying railroad track from Bowling Green to the Tennessee state line and from Bowling Green to Bell's Tavern. I don't know where Bell's Tavern was, but this is a document is dated January the 6th, 1859. So it's an early LNN document, but it goes on for about four pages. And then, of course, a couple of years later, we've got the Civil War upon us. And here is the same bridge again at Munfordville and the high bridge. And you can see a section of it has been destroyed because, you know, we got warfare going up and down this railroad. The Civil War was a war that was largely fought along transportation lines and especially along railroad lines. It's sort of the first modern railroad Civil War. And the little description of this picture down here, which was in Frank Leslie's illustrated newspaper, says this: Great Iron Bridge over Green River on the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, partially destroyed by the rebels to obstruct the advance of the National Army under General Buell. So you get a view of the same bridge here of this Bowling Green and Environs bird's eye view, which was popular in the newspapers then, so people sort of see where armies were, where they were moving. This is Munfordville. This is the bridge. This is Bowling Green back here. Really, the Bowling Green is so far back you don't really get to see it. But this is the Green River. This is the Barren River, and you're heading on down toward Evansville and the Ohio up here. But there are all kinds of encampments all along these lines of transportation and communication here. And here we are in Bowling Green. And the description for this talks about how Bowling Green, parts of Bowling Green had been destroyed. And Carol or somebody here at the Western might know more about this, whether this is actually the fortification where the university is. There's another fortification over here.
It's not where
okay.
It's Baker's Hill.
Okay. Anyway, this again, there's this description here of part of the town being burned down by the rebels. So you can see the impact of the war. The point I'm going to make here is that the war, in some respects, was a very, very profitable time for steamboat companies because they could ship soldiers and war materials along these rivers, get them to railroads, they could transship them. The Sultana was cleared and registered to transport 350-something people. It had over 1,400 people on it. I mean, this was a case of criminal negligence because the transportation company just piled as many people on it as they could. They got so much per soldier per ticket. So the more people they could crowd on it, the more people they put on it. The United States and the America, that collision I showed you earlier, that was the United States Mail Line, which was a privately owned company. It had nothing to do with the U.S. Mail Service. They just sort of borrowed the U.S. Mail name, sort of like that stuff you get in the paper, in the mail that looks like it's official, but it's not. They made a lot of money moving soldiers up and down the Ohio River. And as a matter of fact, they reinvested that money in those two big boats. because they knew they had competition on their hands with the railroads. But we saw that didn't work out. So the Commonwealth comes out of the war in pretty bad shape. Parts of the state have been really ravaged. This area down here around Bowling Green was really beaten up badly by both sides. And so what happens immediately after the war is that the state legislature decides that it doesn't have enough money to get in here on the Green River and fix the locks and dams that had been put in here on the Green and Barren River navigation project back in the 1830s and 40s, which had brought some interesting people with new technological skills in here. Josie Underwood's father came into this community as a part of that movement of skilled people, engineers and lock and dam builders, into Bowling Green. But the Green and Barren River Navigation Company was the answer to this problem about not having enough state money to work these dams and locks over and get them in proper order. And so what happened is a group of businessmen decided, bankers and steamboat people and attorneys, that they would go to the state legislature and say, just let us take over the system, we'll run it, we'll fix it, and we'll set the rates. Well, what eventually happened before too long is that we've got a monopoly here. There's no competition on the line up into Bowling Green or over to Munfordville. There's one line, you know, running a couple of boats, the Bowling Green and the Evansville, run by this Green and Barren River Navigation Company. That goes along for a while until they make a man mad. And that man is Don Carlos Buell. Now, you remember Buell was maybe not the greatest Civil War general in the world, but he had friends in high places. And Buell, immediately after the war, came down here on the Green River and began to get involved in coal mining and some other business endeavors. And this this monopoly was really hurting Buell. So he decided to lead an effort to break the monopoly, basically from his home here at Airdrie on the Green River. This is not his house, and this is not his steamboat. I was always fascinated by what people put on the water and moved up and down the rivers for transportation. It's a little shanty boat, really. Airdrie and Buell's house is up here on this hill, and it was fairly close to Paradise. I don't know exactly what the location is, but what happened is Buell decided that he was going to go to Congress and talk to friends and see if they couldn't break this monopoly and get this transportation opened back up. 1879, Congress orders the Corps of Engineers to investigate. They report, yes, a monopoly exists. And they recommended that, quote, injustice to the country tributary to the Green and Barren Rivers, this area, the present obstructive tax on this commerce should be removed and the monopoly should be broken. In 1886, the Kentucky legislature, by that time, 20 years after the war, maybe had a little more money. But anyway, they still weren't interested in fixing this lock and dam system. So they ceded their rights to the project to the United States. And in 1888, Congress buys the company franchise for $135,000. So the river is open, and it begins to serve the area again. But really, by this time, steamboats will be around well into the 20th century. I'm amazed at how late steamboats were still being built. Some of them into the 1920s. Not many, but a few. But the writing was on the wall because a lot of steamboats were broken up after the war. They had been worn out. I said that their lifespan was only 5 years. It was even shorter during the war. I'll give you one example. The city of Madison, Indiana, was a really nice steamboat. It had been built in the 1850s. It was taken over by the U.S. government, used as an ammunition ship, and it blew up on the Mississippi River. The government had so many of these boats converted to military service that after the war, they were all declared surplus. So they were all sitting around, and if you could get enough money and cobble together a steamboat, you could do it, but they usually didn't last very long. The future was really in
and railroads. This is a photograph from a collection of LNN material we have at the Filson. And we think what is happening here is that the LNN Railroad and Western Union are in litigation. And you've got people going along this railroad employed to take photographs to basically show how close the poles are to the tracks. You know, here's the telegraph line right here. Here's the railroad track. And so if you turn this document over on the back, you find out all kinds of interesting information. Like this is mile 103 looking north toward Louisville. So this is 103 miles south of Louisville. And I don't know railroad miles exactly where this would be. This isn't Bowling Green, but it's some outlying community here which still had its own passenger and freight depot. It's taken at 4:40 p.m. on December the 26th, 1919. The weather's cold and cloudy. It tells you all the information you want to know. And as we move forward into time, railroads are going to continue to haul more and more people and more freight. And the steamboats just aren't going to be able to keep up and compete. So that brings us to the end. And a question about transportation systems today. This is actually that same bridge we've seen several times, the bridge over the Green River. This is a passenger line. I don't know that some of you will remember this, but this diesel engine, supposedly the last run of this Pan American was in 1972. I don't know if that sounds right or not, but that's what some of the documentation says. You know, here in Bowling Green, you had a really good, nice, and still do, architecturally imposing railroad depot over here on back that way, I guess. But now, today, we don't really have an option to get on a steamboat, and I don't know that we really would. I mean, it goes pretty slow. Maybe we take it as a sort of nostalgia trip, but as far as going from one place to another, it's not the most effective way to get there. So they're gone. The railroads now are mainly moving freight. They're not moving people. I'd love to be able to get on a train in Louisville and ride down to Atlanta, someplace like that. But our country hasn't really invested in moving people on rail. I know in talking to my father, and I know most of you in here of a World War II generation, how many soldiers and men and women who were moving around the country during that war saw the country from a railroad car, from a train, a passenger train, and they knew the depots. You know, you get a hint of that when you go up to the Cincinnati Museum Center and see that gigantic Union Station up there and Cincinnati. Well, so now we've got automobile and gasoline dependency. We have a highway and bridge infrastructure that needs repair. They're talking now is $50 billion for runways, rivers, runways, roads, and rail. Again, limited railroad passenger service. All of this, of course, has some foreign policy implications as far as access to fuel. And, of course, we saw in the Gulf, all of them have some sort of environmental implications as well. And thinking about this and reflecting on it as from a bicentennial point of view, it's just that, you know, the steamboat technology was around probably in its heyday for about 100 years. Automobiles have been around for, about 100 years maybe. The railroads have really, as movers of freight, been around late 1830s, 40s, 1940s, for 150 years. And it just seems like maybe we're losing something on that we could learn from European countries where you've got a really good rail system and you can travel around. I know the country is, Western Europe is much smaller than the States, but still, we still do have rail here, and we've got some infrastructure still out there. Okay, I think my time is getting slim. Is that right, Brian?
Getting close.
So I'm going to stop.
We have time for questions. Somebody mentioned, I heard you were mentioning Bell's Tavern. Somebody I heard back here thought it was in Park City. So
help me, Park City.
Just a little ways north.
Not too far from Mount Cave. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The Park City exit. Right. So that may be. I could never figure out whether that 108 miles was as the crow flies or track miles or what.
The 108 miles.
Marker, the 808 mile marker.
Mile markers are still on the railroad.
Okay.
Are they?
Yeah.
Question
yes.
back here.
I have a couple questions. One, the price of a ticket for a passenger. I know they differed between the deck and the stateroom passengers, but how did they compare with the rail?
That's a good question. And, if I said I knew, I really couldn't give you a good answer on it. But it's out there, and it's in the literature and in the primary sources, but that's not something I've really focused on the railroads. I end up with I focused on the steamboats with the railroads sort of playing a part in ending the story along with the disasters. But from an economic point of view, just the fact that the railroads won out seems to suggest that, people eventually just wanted to get from point A to B. They didn't really care whether, the stateroom experience played a lesser part. And they were really depending on freight, remember, to turn the profit. And the more freight you can pile on railroads and move them and get them there, really faster, the more the steamboats were at a disadvantage. And, Brian mentioned this. I mean, I went to this little fishing camp that a bunch of people from my hometown had, and it had really like little cabins and shanties basically, and one guy actually had an old school bus he drug up there, but he fixed it up, but it was still kind of a little community of people that were on the river. And where I got hooked on this was hearing people come up to this place we call McCraney's Landing, and hearing them talk about calling it Boatyard, because Mr. McCraney was the one to let people put these little cabins down there. And we were saying as kids, well, what are you talking about, Boatyard? What Boatyard? And they would say, this used to be a boatyard. This place used to be a place where they built flat boats and cotton boats and, just basically square boxes. And occasionally would build a steamboat hull and on high water launch it and float it down to another city, maybe all the way down to the coast, and put the boilers, the engines, and all that on it, and fit it up, and then run it out. So after I heard about that, I really got interested in the whole steamboat thing. But I'm sorry, I can't answer that particular question.
Yeah, another question over here?
Yeah. Is there any documentation of Indians attacking the early editions of the steamboat?
That's a great question, and I haven't come across it. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, because when you think about 1811 is the date, but you don't really have sustained travel once they worked out all the kinks and got through the monopoly period until into the 1820s. So most of the Indians have been moved out pretty much, but they're still out west. So I would think that on the Missouri somewhere or the Red River, there's got to be some kind of documentation or something like that. And, you think about what Euro-Americans who were settlers out here thought about the early steamboats. I mean, all kinds of people must have scratched their heads to try to figure out what this was all about, how it worked. And actually, I know my time's up, but let me just say one other thing. There is a very interesting reaction to, and I didn't have time to get into it today, to steamboat technology. Anytime there's a new technology and there's progress and change and speed, there's a reaction to that technology. I mean, think about the cell phone. If you walk around on your ear, what's going to happen to us? There are like little waves coming out of here. What are they going to do to our brain? Well, people had the same reaction to the arrival of the steamboat in 1811, because the very year, a few months after the 1811 arrival of the New Orleans at Louisville, what happens out in the Mississippi River off the
west side of Kentucky and Tennessee.
Yeah,
the New Madrid earthquake came. And so preachers were preaching, and they were saying, listen, you know, man might have figured out a way to defy the laws of nature and make a steamboat go against the current, but, you know, somebody else has got an answer to that, and so the earthquake shows up, and the river runs backwards. So there are all kinds of people out here casting about trying to say, what are the religious implications of this new technology? And it continues all the way up to the collision of the America and the United States, that horrific sort of fiery picture I showed you where some Cincinnati newspapers said, you remember that quote in the picture about we moved the chairs back and dancing, there was a band available and we started dancing? That was a quote from the newspaper accounts of survivors of that collision. And what happened is they stayed up partying. There were a couple of wedding parties on the United States going down river. And they stayed up so late, the captain finally had to come down and say, you got to knock it off because people want to go to sleep and y'all are running around here partying. And they had like a little band serenading all the women and going around on the outside. And so they finally did it. So what happened is after this happened, there was a mention in the paper of ministers in Cincinnati saying that, you know, the real reason that accident happened was that people were drinking and dancing on the steamboat. So.
We have time for one more question back here.
Yeah.
Earlier you quoted the figures of tonnage that went through the canal of Louisville. What year was that? What was the tonnage? And then a third question.
I'd have to go back and look at that. I'll give it to you. Okay. I've got the year. Let's see. I don't know if I gave you this. And Portland Canal was completed in 1830, and 456 steamboats locked through in 1831. So it was almost an immediate. Now, that wasn't necessarily different steamboats, but there was still a lot of use that early.
Final question.
Okay.
What's the record of tonnage that did not use the canal that went over the falls?
Don't know. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. Thank you for being here tonight.